headlines. Iran says the removal of all sanctions, which is a prerequisite for the U.S. return to the JCPOA, needs to be verified by Tehran. Newly released satellite images show that Israel, which is widely believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, is significantly expanding its Dimona nuke facility. NUN documents show that private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, helped flow American weapons into Libya in 2019. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Washington's return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningful only if it removes all sanctions against Tehran. Majid Taftar Awanchi said that Iran's acceptance for restricting some of its nuclear activities was in response to lifting of sanctions by the UN Security Council, Europe, and the U.S. He added that the removal of those sanctions must be verified, and a simple statement or a signature would not be acceptable to Tehran. The Iranian envoy stressed that once his country finds the process of sanctions removal was properly executed, it would fulfill its obligations under the deal. Taftar Awanchi also referred to the necessity of compensating Iran for its financial losses, adding that the issue is, however, not a prerequisite for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington's so-called policy of maximum pressure against Iran has not produced results. Blinken made the comment in his first international interview with the BBC. He stressed that his country is not offering Iran any upfront concessions to bring it to the negotiating table. Blinken said if Iran returns to compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal, the U.S. would do the same. The top diplomat added that Washington and its European allies share the same objectives concerning the Iran nuclear deal. He said that other issues, including Iran's ballistic missile programs and its regional activities, also need to be addressed. That is while Joe Biden earlier announced his readiness to re-engage with parties to the Iran deal.
We're prepared to re-engage in negotiations with the P5 plus one on Iran's nuclear program. We must also address Iran's destabilizing activities across the Middle East. And we're going to work in close cooperation with our European and other partners as we proceed.
Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that Washington has no plans to ease sanctions on Iran. She says the U.S. would not issue an executive order about returning to the nuclear deal before possible talks with Iran and the major powers. Political analyst Tohid Asadi says the Biden administration is following the footsteps of its predecessor when it comes to Iran, except some verbal differences.
Practically speaking, at least when it comes to Iran's nuclear program, what we have seen so far is that Biden is trying to follow the same trajectory that Trump administration did, with a slight difference, and that is related to the statements. So they are trying to put forth some arguments based upon the claim that they're trying to fix things, but when it comes to practice, things are almost the same as they used to be during the Trump administration. So far, Iran has seen nothing in practice except for some verbal statements coming from European Union and a unilateral withdrawal from the United States. I think Iran's policy in this regard is very much clear and easy to understand.
New released satellite images reveal a significant construction work at Israel's Dimona nuclear site. An independent group of arms control and non-proliferation experts known as the International Panel on Fissile Material published the images on Thursday. The group's website says the construction has expanded in the Negev Desert and appears to be actively underway. Israel is believed to be the only possessor of nukes in West Asia and estimated to have between 200 and 400 atomic warheads in its arsenal. Israel neither admits nor denies having the nukes, but activists have warned time and again of the enormous threats posed by Israel's nuclear activities. Israel has so far defied international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and never allowed any inspection of its nuclear facilities. Senior geopolitical analyst Alexander Ozadgan says the international community is largely hypocritical in its approach toward Israel's nuclear program.
What was leaked to us by this Israeli nuclear whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, Washington does estimate that Israel has and maintains at least 90 nuclear warheads that have been produced from plutonium. This is something very important because Iran is being accused of this. But to make the matters worse, as everyone knows, Israel is not, like you mentioned, a signatory of NPT, and neither does any of its facilities subject to the IAEA inspection. While all along, not just during the past 5 years, not since July of 2015 that the Iranian nuclear deal was signed, but going back to 12 years prior to that, the Iranian facilities have been inspected, minus the military sites, but the rest of them were literally the most scrutinized nuclear program in human history. There is tremendous hypocrisy here and inconsistency.
Saudi Arabia is planning to invest billions of dollars in its domestic military industry amid international calls for Western countries to end their arms sales to the regime. The kingdom's military industry regulator has unveiled the plan, saying more than $20 billion will be invested in the sector over the next 10 years. It will also allocate the same amount on research and development. The regulator said Saudi Arabia will spend half of its military budget locally by 2030. This comes as the country's arms suppliers, mainly the U.S. and some Europeans, have been criticized for their deals with the kingdom over the Yemen onslaught. Rights groups say that the suspension of such deals would help put an end to the crisis in Yemen. UN documents show private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, have helped flow American weapons into Libya for an assault on the UN-backed government there. UN experts have obtained documents in an 18-month of investigation that shed new light on Washington's weapons proliferation regime. They indicate that private security firms attempted to bring Western military experts, as well as equipment such as drones, speedboats, and assault weapons into Libya in 2019. That's in order to assist renegade General Khalifa Haftar, who was seeking to take control of the country with the backing of some Arab states, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Any transfer of U.S. weapons to a third party is a potential violation of U.N. arms embargoes, as well as America's own laws. But instances reported by the media and rights groups suggest American arms have often ended up in Libya in violation of the UN Charter. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer who joins us on this. So what do you think about the fact that you have private military contractors, including the infamous Blackwater, of having American weapons flow into Libya? Does that surprise you?
I don't find it even remotely surprising. In fact, what we've seen for many years now throughout the region and as far as Afghanistan is that the U.S. prefers to use corporate mercenary forces in order to wage its battles with a measure of plausible deniability built into it. So, no, I certainly don't find it surprising. What I find surprising is that reports of this story seem to be distracting from the main issues by going so far as to focus on suggesting that former President Trump is responsible for all of this, when it's quite clear that the Libya project was commenced by the Obama administration and executed on the United States' behalf by NATO in conjunction with France and the UK, with the support of Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, and others. What I also find surprising, since you asked me what I'm surprised by, is that there's really nobody talking about holding both Prince and Blackwater or his various companies responsible for their, among other things, violations of the UN arms embargo connected to Libya, but more generally for their war crimes, or for that matter, holding Khalifa Haftar responsible, who for many years was a CIA asset. In fact, he's a real Cold War relic, Mr. Haftar, in the sense that he studied warfare in the Soviet Union for several years, as well as in Egypt, and for 20 years was based not far from the CIA, where he was also a student of warfare and a CIA asset that was involved in numerous attempts on Colonel Gaddafi's life and a number of attempts to overthrow Gaddafi. What I find astounding is that there's no discussion in all of this about the appropriateness of Haftar being embraced by most Atlantic world countries, notwithstanding that he himself is quite clearly a war criminal, along with Mr. Prince and Mr. Prince's companies, which operate in open violation of existing UN sanctions and, for that matter, US law. Bearing in mind that both Mr. Haftar and Mr. Prince are U.S. citizens.
Very welcome. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Barry Grossman there, international lawyer. Moving on, a report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security shows right-wing extremists were responsible for the majority of terrorist attacks in the country in 2020. The report is based on a review of last year's domestic terror incidents. This is the first time the U.S. government has publicly acknowledged the rise of right-wing violence despite being documented and investigated in the past. The report comes just weeks after supporters of former President Donald Trump, many of them members of extremist groups, attacked U.S. Congress. Following the January 6th incident, the new administration called for a review of domestic extremism, describing it as a serious and growing national security threat. Another independent report also indicates that white supremacists and other extremist groups had hatched the two-thirds of terror plots in the U.S. in the first 8 months of 2020. Millions of people in the U.S. state of Texas lack access to clean water after an unprecedented winter storm wreaked havoc across much of the country's southern and central parts this week. Texans were seen queuing up for hours on Friday to have safe drinking water and food. The disruption in water and food supplies comes amid record low temperatures that damaged the state's infrastructure and utilities. The deadly polar blast also caused a widespread blackout. Texas governor says more than 160,000 people are still without electricity. President Joe Biden has planned to sign a major disaster declaration for the state. He also called on federal authorities to coordinate disaster relief in neighboring states of Louisiana and Oklahoma that are also hit by the extreme weather. At least 40 people have so far died by the winter storms across the U.S. Argentina's health minister has resigned over claims of improper COVID-19 vaccine allocation. Genius Gonzalez Garcia stepped down after it emerged that some of his friends sidestepped proper procedure for vaccinations. The resignation was tendered on the request of President Alberto Fernandez on Friday. Gonzalez Garcia, a 75-year-old doctor, will be replaced by one of his deputy ministers, Carla Bizzotti. Local media have reported that other people close to the government were also vaccinated at the health ministry without following the procedure. This while Argentina has started vaccinating the elderly on Wednesday after giving the jabs to healthcare workers. Argentina has recorded some 2 million COVID cases and more than 50,000 deaths. World leaders of the G7 summit have pledged millions of doses of the COVID-19 vaccine to poorer countries. However, this has been slammed as just another publicity stunt. The reality is that vaccine rollouts in the world's top economies are in overdrive, but it might take years for poorer nations to get their share. Campaigners say that they want hard facts on how many doses are to be delivered and when.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Anti-coup protesters have taken to the streets of Myanmar amid simmering anger over the death of a young woman activist shot by security forces. Thousands of demonstrators marched through the streets of the capital Naypyidaw and its townships. They chanted slogans against the military and held signs calling for the immediate release of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Over the past few days, thousands more Myanmaris have joined an ongoing civil disobedience campaign. On Friday, a 20-year-old woman became the first fatality among opponents of the coup. She was hit by a live bullet during a rally last week. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of protests since the military seized power on February the 1st. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, over 500 people have been detained since then. Human Rights Watch accuses Indian authorities of adopting laws and policies that systematically discriminate against Muslims and stigmatize government critics. In a report, the leading rights group said prejudices embedded in the governments of the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party have infiltrated independent institutions. This, the report said, has enabled nationalist groups to threaten, harass, and to attack religious minorities with impunity. The report comes ahead of the first anniversary of communal violence in Delhi that killed 53 people, mostly Muslims. The deadly attacks followed months of peaceful protests by Indians of all faiths against the government's discriminatory policies, including a controversial citizenship law. Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny has lost his appeal against what claimed was a politically motivated court decision to jail him for nearly 3 years. The Moscow court did, however, shorten his original prison sentence by 6 weeks. The original term was 3.5 years, but the amount of time he has already spent under house arrest was taken into account. Navalny was jailed on February 2 for violating a 2014 parole, charged that he is dismissed as politically tainted. Meanwhile, Moscow has called on other countries, including the U.S. and EU nations, to stay out of Navalny's case, calling it an internal issue. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Today, with the development of means of mass communication and numerous other technologies, corrupt powers and treacherous hands are capable of changing events and their content. They analyze them in the wrong way and misguide public opinion. In particular, future generations and those who were not present when the event took place, who did not see it up close, and who did not hear about it in times close to the event itself. Today, one of the important things that intelligence services do is that they follow the events and incidents occurring in the world, and after that, they portray them the way they want them to be portrayed. But they do not do it directly. Rather, they do it with others' tongues and pens, with the articles and analysis of well-known personalities in the world, and with the numerous means available to them, including money and use of threats and temptations. Recently, I read a book written by an American writer. Actually, he compiled the book because different individuals were involved in its writing.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
It is about the domination of US intelligence organization known as the CIA over the main newspapers and magazines in the world. The essence of the book is about this matter. It explains how the CIA has interfered in the writings and statements of well-known writers and reputable magazines, and how it has inculcated its own analysis into public opinion instead of the real analysis, and how it has controlled their thoughts. Not only has the CIA done so in American press, but it has also done it in other countries such as European countries. The book mentions a well-known French publication and says that the CIA has done and written such and such things before. This is common practice in the world. By doing this, the CIA is actually inculcating its wrong and distorted analysis about different events into public opinion, thus misguiding people all over the world. This is dangerous that always exists.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran extended full support to African liberation movements. Nelson Mandela, the late South African anti-apartheid revolutionary leader, visited Iran in 1992 to express his appreciation to the Islamic Republic for its support. Mandela was clearly pleased to meet the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on how the Islamic Revolution in Iran inspired liberation movements in Africa, and how African people continue to get inspired by Iran's resistance to Western imperialist countries. Stay with us till the end of our show as our analysts discuss this subject. And don't forget to send us your views as you watch our show today.
Islamic Revolution inspiring Africa. Most countries in Africa, just like Iran, have experienced exploitation of their resources by European and American colonialists. After the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979, liberations movements in South Africa and Namibia looked towards Iran for inspiration in their struggle for independence. The victory of the Islamic Revolution coincided with an era in which apartheid was at its height in South Africa and the masses were resisting the racist regime. Oliver Tambo, the former president of the ANC in exile, was among the first to send words of congratulations to Imam Khomeini after the victory of the revolution. Part of the message stated that the ANC joins all progressive humanity in the celebration of your achievement and welcomes the new Iran into the ranks of the anti-imperialist and anti-racist community of nations. We salute the heroic Iranian people. During his visit to Iran, April 2016, the then South African president, Jacob Zuma, stated that Iran occupies a special place in his country's struggle against apartheid.
Iran occupies a special place in our history of struggle in South Africa. Iran was at the forefront of the fight against apartheid, pledging solidarity with the South African people and cutting ties with the apartheid regime.
The Islamic Revolution in Iran also inspired Islamic and even non-Islamic movements in Africa. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, the incarcerated leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, explains here on the impact of Imam Khomeini's thoughts on other movements.
Also, the revolution has taught us about the power of people. It has impacts elsewhere outside Iran.
Now, for more analysis on the impact of Iran's Islamic revolution on the liberation movement in Africa, we have contacted Said Abdullah Husseini, the director of the Islamic Center for Africa in Johannesburg, and Bukangesa, an activist and commentator based in Nairobi. We shall also be joined later by Suhaila Zakzaki, the daughter of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Now, thank you all for joining us. We're going to start off with Said Abdullah Husseini in Johannesburg. Our first question to you now, can you briefly tell us how the Islamic revolution inspired the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa?
The Shah regime had a very close ties with the South African regime and supporting, and they had also oil business, and the Sasol in South Africa was owned by Shah, but some portion of that was owned by Shah, and a lot of other things to that extent, that even the father of the Shah died here in South Africa and he had a palace here. Well, all of these has made the people in South Africa to hate the Shah regime the same way that they hate the regime of apartheid. So when the Islamic revolution in Iran started, they have realized that they have got a support. And when the Islamic revolution in Iran was victorious, they have come to conclusion that if Iranian managed to get rid of Shah, definitely they also can get rid of the apartheid regime.
Thanks for that, Mr. Husseini, and stay tuned for more.
The Islamic revolution greatly contributed to the eventual victory of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. To practically show how he valued Iran's contribution to his country's liberation, South African anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela visited Iran after his freedom, even before becoming president. When he met the leader of Iran's revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he addressed him as my leader.
During his time as the president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela reiterated his country's diplomatic independence as he welcomed the then Iranian president Ali Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani. During the state visit in 1996, Mandela categorically stated that no country can choose friends for South Africa.
We form our friendships on the basis of principle, and those who are with us when we're all alone will continue to be our friends. And the fact that any particular country may be their enemies does not influence our attitude.
Now, Mr. Husseini, South Africa has continued to enjoy close ties with Iran after the fall of the apartheid regime. Now, how did Iran's support for the anti-apartheid liberation movement impact on the present ties between the two countries?
Well, from before the time of their victory in 1994, Iran was one of the Islamic Revolution was one of the countries which they were supporting unconditional. The struggle in South Africa, in the they were supporting PAC, they were supporting ANC. There was close ties between the Islamic Revolution and the people who were in South Africa doing struggle. And even Nelson Mandela, before victory, after he was released from jail, he had a travel to Iran and also some substantial aid also has been received by the by ANC. And after 1994, then they officially opened their embassy, which was an interest section before, and from that time they are enjoying a good relationship together.
Now, speaking when he hosted President Zuma, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani referred to Iran's assistance to the South African Liberation Movement after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Now, Mr. Husseini, can you elaborate on why the liberation movements in South Africa and Namibia found the Islamic Revolution inspirational?
In spite of the international sanctions, Iran was continuing to have a close ties with South African regime, and they had relationship. This was something which the people in South Africa didn't like from the Shah regime. So when Iranian wake up and started their revolution against Shah, this was an inspiration to the people of South Africa in the South African region, in the Southern African region, actually Namibia and Zimbabwe, other places, all of them, they have been inspired by the Islamic Revolution, because they were saying, if Iranian managed to get rid of Shah, we are also able to get rid of the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Husseini. Now, don't go away. We shall be right back to talk more about how Iran's Islamic Revolution inspired various freedom movements in Africa.
Islamic Revolution Inspiring Africa.
We are back again as we analyze how the Islamic Revolution in Iran inspired and continues to inspire freedom movements across Africa. Now, a popular Islamic awakening movement, also known as the Arab Spring, swept across the Arab world from early 2011. Tunisia in North Africa was the cradle of this movement that touched off a chain of uprisings across many Arab nations. Well, there is no doubt that this popular awakening drew inspiration from Iran's Islamic Revolution. Mr. Husseini, in your opinion, how did Iran's Islamic Revolution inspire the Islamic awakening or the Arab Spring, which started off in Tunisia?
From that time, the Arab world realized that we cannot trust our leaders. And they were waiting for a spark. And that spark started from Tunisia and then went to Egypt and went to other countries. And all of these were under the effect of Islamic Revolution, who was calling for the decline of Israel and the demolition of Islam, the apartheid regime in Israel. So in this way, they have been in the same way that the Hamas was inspired by the Islamic Revolution, the same way that Hezbollah in Lebanon has been inspired by the Iranian Revolution. They did manage to get rid of the Israelis from Lebanon. The people of region also, they have realized that they have power and they are able to deal with their regimes.
Thanks for that, Mr. Husseini. Indeed, power is in the hands of the people. Now, in your opinion, what are some of the weaknesses that made the Islamic Awakening movement in North Africa fail to fully replicate the success of Iran's Islamic Revolution?
Well, that is also something to be discussed because, in fact, the Arab Spring didn't start from Tunisia. The Arab Spring was actually highlighted there. But the Arab Spring actually started when Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, after him becoming victorious in an election in Egypt, he didn't close his relationship with the Israelis, and they wrote a letter to the president of Israel asking him, calling him my esteemed friend, and assure him of continuation of relationship between Egypt and Israel. From that time, the Arab world realized that we cannot trust our leaders. And they were waiting for a spark. And that spark started from Tunisia and then went to Egypt and went to other countries.
Let's move on to West Africa, where Iran's Islamic Revolution has inspired millions of people in this region, which has a rich and ancient Islamic civilization. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria is a popular organization led by Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, currently being detained by authorities since 2015. In late 2015, Nigerian forces brutally attacked Zakzaki's residence in the city of Zaria in Kaduna State and the followers of the peaceful Muslim movement that he leads. In one of his speeches, Sheikh Zakzaki expounded on some of the reasons that led to the success of Imam Khomeini's movement.
Soviet Union collapsed because of it, which was based on false narration. What do you think of what you may call Western ideology, capitalism? Will it survive? Is it based on true narration? Narration of the reality of things. The reason why Imam succeeded is he has based his teachings on true narration of what is truth, through this message of Almighty Allah to entire mankind through his messenger.
Now we are joined by Suhaila Zakzaki, the daughter of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, the leader of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Zakzaki, has also been called Africa's Imam Khomeini. Can you tell us how Iran's Islamic Revolution and its leader, Imam Khomeini, inspired Sheikh Zakzaki?
First of all, I believe that, you know, the Islamic Revolution of Iran has inspired my father greatly in so many ways. I recall him telling a story of how his first introduction to who Imam Khomeini was, which he told me was at a class. It was during a class of when he was in university, and someone was trying, one of their teachers was discussing the subject of influence versus power. And they were trying to explain how certain people might not hold power and have a lot of influence, and that particular teacher cited Imam Khomeini as an example. And he said that Imam Khomeini was like such, the story of Imam Khomeini, just as brief as it was in the class, was quite memorable. And so that was his first introduction to Imam Khomeini when the discussion of his influence in Iran around the time when, he was being cracked down on by the previous Iranian government.
That's quite an interesting insight on how Imam Khomeini influenced Sheikh Zakzaki, who went on to form the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Thanks for that, Ms. Suhaila.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution gave impetus to the nascent Palestinian liberation movement. Palestinians have been struggling for decades to free their land from Israeli occupation, and African governments have been at the forefront of supporting Palestinian liberation. However, before 1979, the masses in Africa rarely participated in rallies to express their support for Palestine. Now, every year across Africa, masses come out massively to express solidarity with Palestinians during the International Goods Day. This day is a legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, who designated the day in solidarity with Palestinians.
Because of we coming from an apartheid situation, the world also did steps like this in support of us. And because of so many marches and BDS movements worldwide, we fought and we broke apartheid. It's important for us to show solidarity with Palestine, because an injustice to one person is injustice to everyone worldwide, and we cannot separate ourselves. We do not live isolated in a world. We cannot keep quiet in the face of injustice. So it's important for us to highlight this, to educate people and to expose what is happening.
Let's now move over to Bukangesa, a pro-Palestinian activist and political commentator based in Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks, sir, for your time. Now, African civil society groups have been organizing the masses to mark the annual International Quds Day in solidarity with Palestine. How did the Islamic Revolution inspire African masses to come out and publicly express support for Palestine?
African people have been, historically being brutalized by colonial and now neo-colonial forces. They draw a lot of inspiration from the consistency in the foreign policy of Iranian people that has been pro-people. For example, we have seen the Iranian people showing their solidarity, the Iranian government showing their solidarity with the oppressed masses in Africa, particularly during the apartheid regime in South Africa. So it's indeed that we also see that the Iranian people have a clear and consistent and even independent policy that is pro-people, and that to us we see it as a big win for all the anti-imperialist and of course anti-Zionist forces that reside here in the global south and elsewhere in the world.
Very well put there by Bukangesa. Resisting Western imperialism is the only way for Africa to attain real independence. Now, as an African inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution, what message do you have for the Iranian people?
You know, the Persian history that is anchored on the spirit of resistance that is continuing to inspire the Iranian people and to continue to refuse, the policy of the thugs in Washington. So African people know this, and they know that to defeat the colonial forces, then it meant a protracted warfare. It was not, a policy of surrender. So we want to pass revolutionary greetings to our Iranian brothers and sisters and tell them that they have the revolutionary credentials, they have anti-imperialism credentials, and even standing tall against the arrogance of the United States of America. And particularly, we are very proud of the Iranian people winning trust across the board.
And just to add to what Mr. Angesa has said there, Iranians have had long and historical ties with the people of Africa for centuries, even before Western colonialists arrived in the continent. Back to you, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now tell us, what lessons do you think can be learned from Iran's Islamic Revolution?
People looked at religion for the most part as something that was backward, as something that was potentially limiting people who adhered to it. And at the very least, even if it didn't limit people, it was only seen as more of a private thing between people and God, and that was it, and nothing more. So the Islamic Revolution of Iran did come and shatter those perceptions, and definitely showed that Islam can be something beyond that, and is something beyond that in all its complexities. the fact that it managed to achieve an Islamic government, an Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thanks for that, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now, Mr. Husseini, you have the last word in our show today. As we know, Iran inspired the liberation movements in South Africa and Namibia. Now, 42 years after the Islamic Revolution, Iran is now a powerful country and has attained self-sufficiency in many sectors despite crippling sanctions. What lessons can African countries learn from Iran in terms of relying on their own resources to attain desired development goals?
The African Union, the African countries must wake up. How long they allow the European and the Western countries to come and take their sources and don't share any of the wealth to the African people.
Well, you have it there. African people must rise and aspire to attain true economic independence for this great continent to prosper. Iran has and will always stand by the people of Africa in their quest for progress and true independence. With that, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of my colleagues, it's goodbye for now and take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyi al-azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We've been studying different features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and after studying the necessity of being balanced, being truthful, being united, we talked about the necessity of observing the rights of each mu'min. And we said there are lots of rights that mu'minin should observe, and these are indeed to keep the community together and form a very solid, united community, like one body, as Rasulullah said, that the example of mu'minin in their love, in their sympathy, in their affection is like one jasad. مَثَلُ الْمُؤْمَنِينَ فِي تَوَادِّهِمْ وَتَرَاحُمْهِمْ وَتَعَاطُفِهِمْ كَمَثَلِ جَسَدْ. It's like one body. Different cells and organs of the same body. I want now to move on to another characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and that is to do amr al-ma'roof and nahy al-munkar.
Mu'mineen need advice, need support. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says,
kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat lin-nas.
You are the best community, the best nation brought out for mankind. This is very important ayah. You know, before I explain this ayah, I have to explain something. Throughout the history, normally every religion has tried to keep its members and adherents together. One way of doing this, which has been very common, is to say, by following this religion, you have salvation and other people go to hell. Or you are a special people, you are chosen people, you are first rank human beings, others are not human beings, or less human beings. So sometimes they have used different techniques to keep their own people together. Because if people think that by following that religion they are not getting anything special, so they say, why we should follow this religion? So they have to be given some kind of privilege. So many people have done this. Unfortunately, even sometimes in religious traditions, people have added this, although this was not in origin. But they say, we are chosen people of God. We are very special. We are awliya'ullah min dun an-nas. We are the people that Allah has chosen us as His friends. But Islam has a different approach. Islam says, kuntum khayra ummah. You are the best nation. But not in the sense that you are to be served, you are to be worshipped, you are superior. No. You are the best which is brought out for the benefit of humanity. Which means you are the best to serve. It's very beautiful. In Islam, if anyone is given any credit, any high regard, it's because he is more beneficial for people. An alim, a doctor, engineer, anyone who is contributing to the life of people receives respect.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That receives the maximum respect among human beings. He never said, I am a special human being. I am, another category. إِنَّمَا أَنَا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ. But why we have so much respect for Rasulullah? Because he is beneficial for us. He is helping us in our salvation. He is conveying the message of Allah. Prophet Isa alayhi salam, he said, when he was born, وَجَعَلَنِي مُبَارَكًا أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُ. Allah has made me Mubarak, means blessed, and the source of blessing wherever I am. Imam said,
Mubarakan means naffa'an. Isa was beneficial. People benefit from Isa. Wherever he is, they benefit. So, a community that serves humanity, is useful for humanity, is better than a community which either is useless or, na'uzu billah, misguides humanity, troubles humanity. Kuntum khayra ummah ukhrajat lin-nas, not alan-nas. Those who know Arabic, they understand. Lin-nas means for the benefit of mankind, not over mankind. We are not over mankind, we are at the service of humanity. So, we as the community of Ahlul Bayt have to be useful for the larger society. Our neighbors and people in our towns and cities that we live, they should say, MashaAllah, this community is so much contributing to the welfare, to the morality, to the spirituality of this town, that everyone is admiring them. In this way we can say, we are kuntum khayra ummatan ukhrajat lin-nas. We have to look after the community and its members, but at the same time we should show to people that we are beneficial for them. Because people, if they don't see that we are benefiting them and we are contributing, then you know they will start disliking us. You have to always give something to people so that they like you. Allah says to Rasulullah, وَلَسَوْفَ يُعْطِيكَ رَبُّكَ فَتَرْضَى. Allah gives you something so that you will be pleased. So what about other people? Everyone is like this. They should feel that they receive something. So we have to contribute to the welfare, and not only financial but also moral, spiritual welfare of the larger society, so that they would be pleased.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
That was The Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way.